The next case is 96-1549, State of Ohio versus Claude M. Meade.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Wait till I call on you, please. Give counsel a little time to get settled there. Ms. Milligan.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I am Diane Smolani, Assistant Prosecuting Attorney from Ohio County, representing the State of Ohio. At this time, I wish to request and reserve 9 minutes for George Stad, my colleague. Basically, a few brief facts. This case involved a defendant who was arrested at County O'Farr in Cleveland for carrying a concealed weapon and having a weapon under his ability with firearm requirement specifications. Defendant never showed up for his rescheduled arraignment date. A habeas went out of him at that point. Then he was arrested, brought back, pled not guilty at his arraignment. He received 3 successive pretrial conferences. And the second pretrial conference was given his April trial date. And that was reaffirmed at his third pretrial conference. Defendant with counsel appeared on the day of trial. He went into the courtroom. He saw the witnesses who were police witnesses lined up waiting to testify against him. These were the same police witnesses who had testified against him in a previous felonious assault case. Counsel, I get the impression from your brief that you're basically asking us to change a lot of the case law that says that the jury trial starts or it attaches or whatever you want to call it after the jury is sworn. You want to move that date up. That's basically what you're asking for. Basically, start of a trial or the commencement of a trial, you want us to move it up to the beginning of the trial day.
Yes, basically that's what we want.
And you're basically asking us to write a proposition of law, if I'm getting correctly, that on the trial day, if the defendant shows up and the jury's ready and the parties are ready, that trial has commenced for the purpose of being able to go forward if he's gone.
That's correct. When the issue is, when this trial commenced? And did the trial court properly interpret Rule 43? And we say,
but don't we?
Yes.
Don't we have to take into consideration the issue of double jeopardy, and that's really why we determine when the trial commences, and it generally commences with the calling of the first witness. My problem with this case is I have no problem when a trial has actually called, open statements have been made, witness called, the defendant absconds. Judge proceeds without the defendant being present. But explain the justification in this case, why a judge, the case had not commenced for, you know, and as Justice Stratton has stated, we have a lot of case law out there that says cases commence with opening statements and calling of witnesses. What was the need to proceed without the defendant's presence under these, especially in view of the fact of this historical absences that you have given us? What was the purpose of it?
Well, first of all, the state truly believed that trial had already commenced.
You'll have to address that in light of double jeopardy. Are we going to say then that trial commences for double jeopardy purposes when the day starts?
Well, this isn't a double jeopardy case.
Well, but that is the reason. That is the underlying reason that a case can proceed without the defendant being present. We can't escape that.
But the defendant here in this case was present. He knew the trial date was that day. And he left without the trial court's permission because he realized he was going to get jail time. And that he saw the witnesses against him. He went, he lied and said he was going to the cafeteria, and he left and never
came back. Do you have any support, any case law that has been upheld when a trial judge commences the trial, calls?
Well, first of all, the trial court is the master of the courtroom. He's the captain of the ship, it's a common sense approach. And plus, in the revised code, section 2311.07, which is order of hearing cases, the trial court sets when the cases are heard. And this defendant knew when his trial was. He came in. He wanted to get a better plea, and he didn't like the plea he was going to get from the prosecutor, so he decided to leave. And what we want is this kind of situation stopped, where the criminals can come in and think they can set the time and the place and the circumstances of their trial.
So we should ignore the constitutional right for a defendant to be have a right to be present at his trial.
He waived that constitutional right.
Did he, what did he do with 2945.12? I didn't find any analysis in your brief of that statute, which says, you know, no other person shall be tried unless personally present, but if a person indicted escapes or forfeits his recognizance after the jury is sworn, the trial shall proceed and the verdict is received and recorded. What do we do with that statute?
Well, the state doesn't believe it applies because the trial had already commenced and the defendant...
You're really asking, I have the same problem, the same question, I guess, that Justice Resnick has. You want us to say the trial commenced here for this isolated purpose, but not attach double jeopardy. How do we do that? We single out, we say a trial commences for purposes of a defendant leaving the courtroom, that's one purpose, and it commences when the jury is sworn for all their purposes? Can we do that?
Well, not necessarily.
Should we do that?
A defendant voluntarily waived his right. So this is a situation where his constitutional rights were definitely allowed, and he took it upon himself to leave that courtroom and waive that right.
But the trial hadn't commenced yet, had it?
Well, the
under everything we have, the point 12, the criminal rules, the trial had not yet commenced, had it? And there's nothing that says that a person. I mean, you have a good strong public policy argument, but there's
and that
statute.
Is one of our best arguments that you cannot let this continue to happen.
Well, it appears to me that the fault is with the trial judge. Wasn't there many indications prior to this that the defendant was unlikely to appear at any time in the future?
But he did appear.
Well, wait a minute. Let's stick to my train of thought. He had not appeared on many occasions, and to me, it would be an indication to the trial court that, hey, we have to take this into consideration and determine whether or not we should take this man off bond and put him in jail. But didn't he ignore many indications that this man is probably not going to appear for trial?
Well, the trial court knew he appeared for three successive pretrials, and that he appeared on the day of trial. The only thing he didn't appear for was his rescheduled arraignment date.
Okay. So there was not that great evidence that he would not appear for trial.
Correct. And at that point, when he was there, everybody was there. The jury was lined up, waiting to walk in. The trial court was there. The bailiff was there. The deputies were there. The witnesses were there. Both prosecution and defense counsel were there.
The witnesses were in the room?
Correct. And that's when the defendant realized he had every indication that he was going to go to jail. Because his defense attorney told him he couldn't get a better plea, he saw the police and he decided to leave.
Could the trial court have, after he left that time and brought back, could the trial court put him in jail and hold him there until the trial started, until the jury is sworn?
Yes, and in fact they did issue a habeas for him to bring him back. His defense attorney tried to locate him. The trial court tried everything they could to get this man back. He ignored it. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Smenaliak. Mr. Saad, you're going to take rebuttal. Is that right?
Okay.
Mr. Green.
Good morning. My name is Donald Green. representing Claude B.
Mr. Green, when I was a trial judge, this happened to me, trial was trying to count probably about 15 different times. You know, Franklin County, we probably have 10, 15 pleas in negotiation at any one time.
And, you know, invariably, some attorney would come back with a sheepish grin on his face and say, "I'm sorry, my client took off," and you know that the jury was ready and the trial was ready, and you know that he didn't like the deal. What penalty should attach to somebody like that? Why shouldn't we accept the argument that, he did waive his rights when it was the trial day and he initially showed up and then he left? Why shouldn't we accept that argument that there's a waiver and we have the right to proceed with trial?
Well, kind of counting. I'm not sure what number is of cases there are out there for defendants who don't show up for court appearances. But it's in the thousands, and of course that is probably 10,000, 15,000 or more. Most of them, know they're wanted in court.
But when they show up on the day of trial,
okay,
and you say you're going to trial, you're next on the list and you're going to trial, and you say to the judge, "Give me one last chance to talk to my client," which happened to me a lot of times. You give them that one last chance to talk to the client, they come back and say, "I can't find him, Your Honor." What's the penalty?
Believe me, it's happened to me too. I mean, it's a different judge.
Sure.
They take off, you know, you can't chain them down. What we're looking here is rules of law, criminal rules, procedure, statute. What is the rule? My position is it is revised code 2945.12 or criminal rule 43. What does that say? I think the legislature and courts know, as you yourself just said, what some of the problems here are. So we haven't legislated for past rules to say, okay, if we give notice to a defendant that they're doing trial and they don't show up, we try them anyway. That's not what the rules say. The rules say, 2945 says, no other person shall be tried unless personally present, but if a person would have escaped the forfeit is recognizant after the jury is sworn.
So are you saying that really that their remedy is to go back to the legislature rather than seek it from us?
Yes. I mean, this is what's after jury sworn. Was the jury sworn here? No. No doubt about it, jury was not sworn. Criminal Rule 43 says after the trial has been commenced. Was the trial commenced here? Their argument sort of was because what the judge did, because nobody here was in that courtroom when it happened, was had a jury pull up 25, 26 members and was going to call them in the courtroom if he didn't plead and start going through the procedure. My position is that's not a start of a trial. You start the trial with a court of jury and you start going through court again. So under that standard, the trial hadn't commenced under the Criminal Rule 43A. It hadn't been commenced. So, I mean,
You're basically saying
the
rules really don't give a penalty for this
situation. No, I mean, if you don't like what happened, this guy took off. I mean, I'm not playing around. He took off because he thought he was going to get a one to prison. So the rules say you don't go ahead with a trial if the guy is gone. It's not a courtroom. You don't go forward unless you've got the guy in custody. And you can go forward if he acts up in court, you know, misbehaves so that proper procedure in court doesn't occur, or he takes off during the middle, the steps after the jury is sworn. And there's some other cases or whatnot that says, you know, maybe during ordeal or something like that. But in Ohio, it's clear. I mean, I don't know how else to read this.
So you say the remedy really is, well, when you catch him, put him in jail, then you try him.
Right. I mean, that's what's done every day. I mean, the justice is talking about what happened numerous times, and I'm sure that's what she did. And she just said, he's gone, issue cases, when you got it, you don't let him out, and you bring him in. I mean, there's a number of guys with the deputy behind him in courtrooms. And then they go into the little, I don't know every other court, but in Delaware County, they go into that little room off to the side when there's breaks. And that's the correct procedure.
Can you grab him right on the street as he leaves the courthouse?
Yeah, I do.
But there's no way to prevent him from leaving. You can't revoke the bond or the bail at that point. And if he's down the steps, he could have been going to the coffee shop. So do you wait till he gets out on the steps and then you grab him and then put him in jail? Because otherwise you'd have to wait until he issued a capias.
There's problems always with bond.
But there's no way to do this, is there, like
there's
that?
There's no way to get to the head of the person who's on bond. Whether you're going to skip or not. I mean, I guess you do proper bond procedures, ties to community, consequences of the of a trial and that sort of thing, determine if the bond is a high risk.
Well, he's obviously out on bond and it's OR or otherwise, so you have to revoke it before you can take him.
Yes.
Okay. So you can't revoke it until you know he's not there for sure.
Well,
maybe he was going down the parking meter.
I mean, you call a case, he's not there, you revoke his bond, then you pick him up. I don't know how can you explain it.
You can't, that's why.
Huh?
You can't explain it. I mean, he's just gone.
Well, he left. I mean, he didn't want to go. I'm not going to make excuses for him. He didn't want to go to trial. Because he's going to go to prison.
We're balancing here, aren't we? Like we do so often in criminal law, we're balancing. We have the what we believe in this country is a very, very strong constitutional right for somebody to be present at trial when they're being tried for a crime. That's basic. And they have on the other hand, we have this at the balance against that person, such as your client or the defendant here, who doesn't understand that that's important, that he be in trial. He leaves. And so we try to balance that. General Assembly has attempted to do it with legislation. We've done it with the court rule. And it seems to me that if the balance needs to be changed somehow, probably ought to be done in a legislative sort of manner rather than us taking a case. You're the wrong person to ask, which is sad, help me on this, but can you think of how we can write an exception to point 12 without affecting the double jeopardy issue?
No, I mean, we can argue here among us about the constitutional issue of being present. I don't think this reaches that because there's rules and statute that protects us that was given before you even reach that. I think the Supreme Court did that they're saying, you know, their Rule 43, which is almost exactly like ours, say you cannot do it, you know, we don't have to reach the constitutional issue. You cannot do it until the trial's commenced.
And they did away with the concept that a defendant could voluntarily waive this, that it wasn't waivable in trial.
Well, they didn't do away with it, but they drew a line which sometimes is very good. I taught at Cleveland Marshall, of course, and we were always arguing about, you know, students don't understand where the lines are. And I would tell them that's very good because that's why they hire you to move the lines back and forth. And that's why you get paid. But here, in this one, there is a line that says after the jury is sworn. I mean, that's a high line. You know, the jury's sworn, yeah, you can commence. If it's not, you can't. After the trial is commenced, you're supposed to interpret these so they don't conflict. If they conflict, you try to, figure out where it goes. But the criminal rule and the revised code, I think, can be read together and say after jury sworn, even if not, you go after trial is commenced. Either way, the trial hasn't commenced yet. And if you look at the transcript, I don't know who was in the courtroom, if he saw the witnesses or not, because I wasn't there, and neither was anybody here in this courtroom. But he did take off before the trial commenced, because he didn't want to go to trial. He didn't take off after they impaneled the jury, or after he started for a general jury, after the jury was sworn. He took off before all that happened. He said, we're going to take you to trial if you don't plead. And this is what you get to clean. And he took off.
I suppose one way to attempt to avoid this, maybe it wouldn't be avoided, but I noticed that the defense counsel here advised, were you trial counsel or?
No, it was with my office.
Okay, the counsel apparently told the defendant not to go, and he went anyway. I suppose one thing, the trial judge could instruct the defense counsel to go with the client, and at least they'd know whether he's down the steps of the courthouse or in the coffee shop or whatever. That's maybe too practical, but it would be a one way.
I just only wish that clients take my advice. Don't leave. You know, don't do that to me here in this courtroom. And I wish they would listen. But, I know that that's counsel, and I know he told him, you're not hungry, you're not going to get something to eat.
Well, I guess my point is that, again, we're balancing, and there are ways to perhaps prevent this from happening in some instances, so that we don't get ourselves into trying to write an exception around when a trial commences and the double jeopardy issues and so forth.
Well, like I said, I don't think you have to write an exception or explain something that's unclear or something that's fuzzy or when a search begins or something of that nature. The legislature here has made a rule that is, I understand it, and I think everybody here understands it, after the jury is sworn. For whatever reason, I don't know the legislative history of that particular statute. Ohio isn't very good on providing legislative history, but that is clear what they wanted. Now, in this case, brings about some movement in the legislature in which they think Mr. Meade made a mockery of the court system, and they want to change it to the fact where he has notice and he appears for the trial date, and then they start without him. Then we can argue the constitutional ramifications of this, whether that is a constitutional violation or not.
Are you fully satisfied with the Court of Appeals opinion? They analyze it correctly and came around with the right law, like it's always been?
Yes.
Okay, thanks.
And let me go there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Green. Mr. Saad, you have about a little over 6 minutes.
Yes. Please, Chief Justice, and members of this court, I've appeared before this court numerous occasions. I have never heard of such a radical proposal proposed by counsel, that if an individual defendant who decides to run at the start of the trial can run with impunity and disgrace the state court system and frustrate the interest of the public in bringing him to trial and violate all speedy trial concepts that this court has consistently upheld. Well, this is quite shocking to me. As for his great reliance on 2945.12, with all due respect to this court, that statute has absolutely zero application to your decision in front of you. That speaks of an absent defendant. That statute does not address the question of a present defendant standing able to go to trial. So 2945.12 absolutely has no application. This court, Justice Warren, requested of me to give a reasonable explanation rather than going through a legislative enactment, which might take perhaps years before we can get to any rock-bottom solution to this problem. The rock-bottom solution is as plain as the nose to our face, and that solution is one of abuse of discretion. And the only issue before this court is did the trial judge abuse his discretion in allowing this individual to go to trial when the trial date had been set? And you look at Judge McGinney, you look at his explanation and his opinion, and he sets forth numerous factors why he did what he did. He stated in his opinion that the defendant had three trials and repeatedly informed of the trial date. There was no request for continuance filed by defense counsel. The jury was walking into the courtroom. Jurors were given numbers. All parties were present. The defendant asked for a last-minute plea bargain. When the defendant heard of the outcome that he had to go to jail, his great words were, "I'm going to get something to eat." The defense attorney told him not to leave. There was an extensive search for the defendant. The trial judge issued the utmost caution. He only continued, he conducted a voir dire. And after the voir dire was the first time that defense counsel objected to this continuance. And then the trial lawyers left notes with the defendant to come back to court. He never did. Then the trial court made a finding. And that finding was that this defendant voluntarily, knowingly, and intelligently walked out of his trial. He had a yellow streak from his neck down to the bottom of his toes. He decided to run.
Mr. Saad, what do we do with the statute, point 12? I mean, how do we... I assume you don't want us to say that for double jeopardy purposes, you as a prosecutor would not want us to move that date earlier in the proceedings, do you?
No, for double jeopardy purposes, I think the statute is self-sufficient and it has no problem or application in this particular case. Jeopardy attaches when the jury is sworn or in a bench trial when the first witness is sworn. This is not the determination of what constitutes a trial. Judge Resnick asked, does the state have any case law as to when a jury starts? Yes, we look to our federal courts, because Ohio is very sparse law. And I think that's why this court took this case into consideration, because Rule 43, there's absolutely no authority. But you look at its counterpart, federal Rule 43, and you see a whole plethora of cases. And those cases from U.S. versus Kraut cited in the brief and U.S. versus Totoro, and the rule had been up to 1943 that if a defendant did what this defendant did in an Ohio court, he could be tried as long as he had notice of the trial date. Then in 1993, a case comes down, a very significant case, and that case is called United States for Crosby versus the United States. What does Crosby hold? Crosby holds, the United States ruled that a defendant may not be tried in absentia if he was not present at the start of the trial. So the key words that you see in 43, both federal and state 43, is this defendant initially present? The double jeopardy provisions that relate to and talk about when jeopardy attaches and when trial starts absolutely have no bearing in this particular case.
Constantly.
The corollary of Crosby is equally true. If the defendant is present for trial, okay, then the trial has commenced.
You like the federal case, and that says if he's present at the start of the trial. No. There has, I mean, that's a, you're still talking about a bright line. Why wouldn't the bright line be at a minimum that the judge had assumed the bench and commenced to do something? The court reporters in the place that the judge is at least on the bench and something that's being taken down by a court reporter is transpiring. Or if it's maybe even take it a step further than that. The judge is back in his chambers, the lawyers are present, the court reporter's in because they're going through preliminary motions and putting something on the record. But shouldn't you at least have a record underway going to that?
That's what the trial holds, respect, Justice Breyer. The trial is called when the judge calls and sets the case for trial. The defendant is present, the witnesses are present, defense counsel is present. You cannot allow a defendant to walk away with impunity and disregard the trial date. There is no case law that says the trial starts when the jury is sworn.
So if you would have the bright line test be if it's 9 o'clock in the morning, the case is set for 9 o'clock in the morning, the judge is back in his office having coffee and donuts and the judges are in.
It's not so much concerned, Justice Piper, with a bright line. The case law interpreting Rule 43 concerns itself with one thing, and that is, was the defendant present or was he absent? Did he have notice of his trial? And that is the crucial and deciding factor. The bright line test is really not applicable to the situation. The applicable standard to be applied according to Federal Rule 43 and its counterpart is whether there was an abuse of discretion on the part of the trial court. You have to balance the trial court's actions in light of what occurred so that justice may be given. So you take the competing interests. You say, what were the interests or the factors that the trial judge decided to proceed to trial in absentia? Now, Judge McGinney issues his factors, and I'm not going to bore the court with repeating all those factors were persuasive enough. Then you look at the defendant's interest, then what interest did he have in not showing up for his trial? And then outweighing that process, then you come up with your common sense conclusion. Was the trial judge, did he abuse his discretion or not? That is the bright line test. There is no other bright line test.
The bright line would be, did he have notice?
The bright line test is as stated by Crosby versus U.S., and that's the only definitive Supreme Court case on the issue. And that speaks only to one factor, and that factor is, was the defendant present for the commencement of his trial? If he was physically present and decides to skip, then the state can try it.
Quoting from your own brief, Crosby said, the Supreme Court in Crosby encouraged continuation of a trial once begun with or without a defendant, and disappears derives under the option of gambling. But the key words in all of these cases that you've cited, these federal cases, it says once the trial has commenced.
Correct.
I don't think that they're meaning once the date has been set for trial.
There's no question that's one of the issues, Justice Rivers. When did the trial
Mr. Sad, there's so many areas of the law that are so uncertain. Why would we argue about when a trial commences? This has been decided for years. It's when the jury's sworn, isn't it? Why would we change that now? Why would we throw some uncertainty in the law because this person absconded? There are other ways to get at that issue, aren't there? And if they're not, the General Assembly is fully capable of. If it's having the kind of impact on the criminal justice system, as you say it is, it would seem to me that it'd be very easy to get the General Assembly to change.
It's easy to do, but there's also an abuse of discretion standard that's even easier to apply in this particular case, Chief. Now, that abuse of discretion weighs the competing factors, and that's what you have to do in the Rule 43 situation. And the problem is we don't have any guidance from the Supreme Court on this.
We do.
But this court would come back and say, well, Rule 43 does not apply because trial has not commenced, and put the easy way out. Then, what would occur is, then aren't we inviting people to come forward and just run, and just say the classic phrase, feet don't fail me now, as they run out of the courtroom, and run down the street away from the apprehension by the sheriff? Or is this court going to be bold enough and take a look at its federal counterparts and say that, hey, maybe this prosecutor by the name of George Sand has approached this problem as an abuse of discretion and given us an opportunity to prevent this type of conduct?
The lead federal case you cited was a 1972 case, a circuit case, which was at least implied they were ruled by Crosby. In 1993. That can't be a good case.
The latest case is United States versus, I believe it's Trout, and that's cited in our brief, and it's 56 Federal 3rd, 643, 1995. And the opening says, we find the reasoning of our civil service to be persuasive on this issue, and all for the purposes of Rule 43 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure, trial begins when jury selection begins. So you call that jury, the jury had their numbers, they're sitting there waiting to be called, and this defendant decides to skip.
That's true.
Am I talking too much?
Yeah, your red light's been on for a while.
I think you've used your time, Mr. Sad. With 10,000 cases running around.
You've used your time, Mr. Sad. You've used your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I will take a brief recess.
All right.